AG1.
What's up? I'm here to talk to you about AG1 Athletic Greens again. You know, it's important to me that the supplements I take are high quality, and that's why I've been taking AG1 for, what is it now, 4 years, 3.5 years or something like that? The thing I like about it is it's researched and developed by an in-house team of scientists, doctors, and nutritionists with decades of experience in their fields. So you know it ain't BS, it's AG. They are the real deal. I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't a buzzword. They really push hard. Expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, rigorous testing. They got it all. At each step of the process, AG1 is going above and beyond. Now, what I like about them, first of all, you can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because it's an NSF certified for sport, which is like a rigorous, independent quality. They've tested for over 950 contaminants, banned substances. The industry standard apparently is only testing for 10. Dude, it's 95 times as rigorous. And it's not complicated. It's so simple. It's just replacing health supplements like multivitamins, digestive aids, immune support, in just one simple scoop. It takes 60 seconds. You don't have to swallow a bunch of pills on an empty stomach. Boom. And as I always say, you get a little bit of water in there too. Get that day started. So with the water, and then for me, the prebiotics, probiotics, and digestive enzymes for gut support is probably the most important ingredient. I eat a pretty varied diet, so I get my nutrition from a lot of places, but I got to eat more fermented foods. But AG1 lets me have this prebiotics and probiotics first thing in the morning. Take care of my digestive enzymes, which if you're a listener of the podcast, you know I need help with. All right. Look, I've partnered with AG1 for so long because they make a high-quality product that I genuinely look forward to drinking every day. I chug down an AG1 maybe within 10 minutes of getting out of bed. It's the way I start my day every day, even on the road. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/mighty. That's DRINKAG, the number one, .com/MIGHTY. drinkag1.com/mighty.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
What's up, shitheads? Welcome back to another episode of High and Mighty. It's me, your boy, the number one fuckboy. The number one fuckboy. The number one fuckboy. Joining me, as always, in the studio is the nearly silent co-host, Arthur Gabrus. Arthur, give him a shout-out, boy. That's practically nothing from Artie. Hey, full disclosure to listeners, he's actually not in the room. He's tired in the living room, poor guy. Party hard this weekend. Artie parties hard. Also joining me in High and Mighty Studios for the first time, not our first time hanging out, as you'll hear about shortly after this, but writer, comedian, eater? I mean, it feels weird to say your job location, but it is technically also a title. Yeah. We all carry the title of eater with us. Guys, put your hands together, your virtual hands, your little fake VR hands, put them together for Farley Elliott.
Woo! Top 10 fuckboy calling in. Yeah. I don't want to say too. Somebody else on this podcast, I'm sure, has already claimed the second spot, but I don't need to take it from them.
Yeah, you're saying I'm at least nine. I'm around nine.
Yes, that's exactly right. Phil Rosenthal, somewhere in this ranking, I'm sure. Sure.
If I got Phil Rosenthal to say he was the number one fuckboy on this podcast, I would hold that over him for the rest of my life. I don't think he would say that.
No, I don't think so either. With a guest like a Rosenthal, who just by process of having made it in the entertainment industry and being a fucking gazillionaire as a result, is he a person where you record the intro separately, or do you do it in front of him and feel the shame?
No, part of it is I want to beat myself down in front of all my guests so that they know, well, at least whatever I say is not going to be garbage.
Right.
Learned that this is not as alienating as I thought it was, okay, doing it in front of people. Yeah. But Phil is one of the people I consider just getting it in the can without him there. Because it just feels weird to do that in front of Phil. Like,
yes.
Just the sweetest old man, I'm screaming curse words, but also I'm like,
take me seriously.
Right. And that's sort of part of it too, is like, there's just so many angles. The age is its own thing that, right, like, I don't want to do this in front of someone who's just a generation older than me. Plus the money, plus the, yeah, all of it.
Yeah. And all the, cause we're all both also Doughboys listeners, and you can hear it in Mitch's voice when he doesn't want to play the drop in front of someone.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
When he doesn't want to do, hi-yo.
I always feel like he's like pinching a nerve just off mic or something to get those specific sounds.
Jesus, Mitch, fucking spit out the milk. All right, so we're going to read some negative reviews of my podcast before we talk. So as always, listeners, you might know this. If you rate me 5 stars and roast me in the comments, I will read it on air. And yes, this is a blatant grab for stars, but I don't even know who goes by this anymore.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it's like anything. Algorithms are meaningless, but also control everything around us.
Right. I'm like, yeah, this is all bullshit. But for real, though, can I please get
it? Yeah. But
stars?
Honestly, it matters.
Because, like, I have over 1,000 5-star ratings. And I don't know what that means at all.
Do you ever go and, like, look at who is in, like, the comedy section and people that are doing well and things like that?
I should do that. Should I also, while I have this open on my computer, should I also subscribe to my own podcast?
You know what?
Just get the listens on.
I say give yourself something to hope for.
Are you sure you want to subscribe to High and Mighty? Yeah, I think so.
Look at the hurdles that these nice people are having to go through to keep you around.
Kyle, please let me get my Mac Weldon money, baby. All right.
Have you ever in your life left a review for a podcast?
No. I think I did once for Don't Get Me Started, because they were doing a bit where if you commented the word hello, they would say hi back. And I thought that was really funny. So I wrote it. Oh, no worries. That's always broken. You didn't do that, though, either.
Right? I mean, I lifted my foot and broke it. So.
All right. That's fine. But that happens every day.
Good.
I thought it first finally happened on its own. Maybe I shouldn't put thousands of unread friends books on the bottom. All right. This one's called 5 stars? ? Of course, by OMG Genius. Wow. So glad to see Artie Lang has escaped the hospital and somehow managed to start a podcast. His alter ego, John, is perhaps what Artie thinks a slightly better version of himself might be, although his trademark interrupting and self-serving stories are a dead giveaway of who John really is. The scary part of the show is his real dog named Artie, which he talks to and tells guests that he can be annoying. Artie's sister and mom, it's time to step in, and before he hurts the woman he has locked up in there. 5 stars all day.
I gotta say, there's a little bit of a through line, obviously, with Artie the dog, Artie the name, Artie the guest host. I think there's a conspiracy angle to this one that I really like.
Yeah.
They built a nice world.
Yeah. We're nudging at Pizzagate at this point.
Yes, exactly.
One time I mentioned Pizzagate on the podcast, like in a stoned conversation with Anthony Atamanik, and I rarely get people that write to disagree with me, like, or one person just like wrote me an email that's like, I was a fan of your podcast till you dismissed Pizzagate so easily. This is children are getting molested. I hope you're happy or whatever. And
oh
then like, was like, you lost a listener.
Whoa.
I was like, wow, I can't believe I mean, I guess I can believe that someone that listens to this podcast also believes Pizzagate.
Oh, yeah, the Venn diagram is almost a full circle.
It's terrifying. But also at the same time, it's like, I couldn't imagine, like, this is the podcast. Like, I'm rarely political.
Right.
And if you think me getting political is saying, I doubt Hillary Clinton molests children in the basement of a pizza restaurant. If you count that as like a bold political stance, feel free to fucking stop listening to this podcast.
The Pizzagate thing too is something that is like, out of all the conspiracy theories in the universe, the one that is so demonstrably false, they don't even have a fucking basement there.
Right.
Like, there's just so much that is so clear. You don't need to show up with an AK-47. You can do it on the internet.
That shit truly terrifies me. Truly, because people can believe almost anything. That is so far from even reality of like the connections that the conspiracy makes.
Right.
It's like pizza is code for ordering children.
Oh, man.
It's like if you've ever worked on giant like group events, it's like you're always ordering pizza for all the fucking interns working late.
Right.
Like, I guess let's get some pizzas. And it's like, they're ordering children to a DNC meeting.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Oh, no. Pepperoni. That's the worst kind of child. This is from Dial Up Modem. And the title of the review is He Is. And the review is the word fat. So he is fat. Thank you, Dial Up Modem. I guess that's about the minimum amount of work you could put in to get both a roast and a 5-star review, right?
Yeah, even just by process of like, did you put a period at the end of fat?
Nope.
See, that guy's really shaving spades. That's like seven letters to roast you with 5 stars.
If he would have contracted he is to he's, he would have saved
himself. You're done at that point.
Here we go. Cobra Lily. Virulent and aggressive desperation. Slightly more upsetting than visiting a chronically underfunded animal shelter, Mr. Gabriel spends an hour trying to fill the ever-expanding void in his vapid Hollywood existence with an inane, nonstop avalanche of drug-addled word salad. 5 stars.
Okay. That's one of the most densely packed sentences I've ever heard somebody read, and they accused you of word salad.
I know. This person fucking busted out their thesaurus, their word-a-day calendar, and really got their money's worth.
Yeah, I will say, I wrote a book last year. It's all about the history of street food in Los Angeles. It's just called Los Angeles Street Food, and a lot of it was institutional knowledge that I had about like places around Los Angeles, but man, I would spend nights poring over that thing being like, I just need more words. And I like high school style. Like, how do I just type in more words?
How do I just add more words to the carnitas chapter?
Yeah, yeah. And sure as shit, like, if you go on my Amazon page, there's one 1-star review, and it's a woman who, like, just knows exactly what I was about in my lowest moments. And it's so heartbreaking because she has some fucking real truth to everything she's saying.
The author, Farley, goes on 5 different tangents about the same bathroom remodel that must have been going on in his house while he was writing this. Right. Like, some weird obvious parallel.
Yes.
Much like the film 3 Billboards, like whatever's happening. You're just
sweating out 80,000 words.
All right, here's one last one, then we'll get into it. This is from Northwoods Kid. He only has one thing is the name of the review. John Gabris constantly talks about how he wants to lose weight, but sadly the only thing he has going for him is his fat gut. Not as funny as Nicole Byer, agreed. Not as lovable as Mike Mitchell, agreed. Not as insightful or good at improv as Lauren Lapkus, agreed. You won't lose weight because in the end, you aren't the fat, funny guy. You're just the fat guy. Ouch, dude. Yeah, that one hits hard because that's my biggest fear.
Yes, of course.
I'm like, oh, I don't want to get skinny, then I won't be funny. It's like, no, you're not funny at all.
There's no such thing as like a humor molecule residing in the larger torso of white men everywhere.
Adipose tissue is where all the humor molecules sit. Motherfucker. I will say, I don't want to be petty, but hey, Northwoods Kid, if I'm just the fat guy, your is Y-O-U apostrophe R-E.
Got him! Nice
try, motherfucker. I win. I'm just tears pouring down my face.
That's not how you spell your. I'm cutting every cord to this podcast setup because I've won.
No more 5-star reviews. Guys, as always, rate me 5 stars, roast me in the comments. You cannot be mean enough. Try it. Let's try to get extra mean this year, guys.
Okay.
Sign your friends' iTunes accounts up. If they don't even listen, just sign in as them and roast me. Who gives a fuck? All right. Enough about me. I'll interject myself 1,000 times into this conversation about fine dining.
Ooh.
The reason we connected was you're a food writer. I'm a food eater. You also eat. And then I was like, we got to have you on the podcast to talk about your book and all this shit. And then you were like, how about this? Let's go out to eat. And then we can talk about something different, like fine dining. We'll go out to a nice restaurant. I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And then your next email was like, of course, this will be paid for. I was like, yeah, this sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
a free meal in exchange for a podcast?
I didn't want you to like sweat too much over how much you thought I was going to charge you to be on my podcast. So I was like, no, there are old white men in New York who will pay for this. So yeah, it's fine.
We're made in the shade. Yeah. We're made in the shade. So we went to 71 Above.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is named that because it's the 71st floor in a tower.
Yeah, inside the U.S. Bank Tower, which, and this is sort of getting into like a weird sidebar, but depending on who you ask, is the tallest building west of the Mississippi. They just recently built, the Intercontinental Hotel built a tower that is technically taller because they have one of those spires.
But some people don't count spires because there's nothing inside of it.
Right, but everything, like if you just looked at the skyline of Los Angeles, it is demonstrably taller, the U.S. Bank Tower, than that spire building.
It felt tall being up there.
Yeah, you're at helicopter height. So
right, a helicopter was flying by at like eye level.
Yeah, and he's like, how's your meal?
He gave us a thumbs up. You went with the chicken. But fine dining is not a thing I normally do, or it sounds like you normally do.
Yeah, you know, so I'm the senior editor of Eater here in Los Angeles, which is a big food publication. So I cover everything from breaking restaurant news to big trend pieces, things like that. I'm not a critic, but I'm always kind of talking about the ins and outs of the restaurant world. And so a lot of what I choose to spend my time talking about is usually street food. It's kind of everyday stuff, neighborhoods, communities, things like that. I don't do a lot of fine dining just because it's not my background. It's not something I even feel super comfortable in. But I do find myself listening to other food podcasts, and it's always fast food conversations or like, which pizza is better?
Yeah,
or
like,
dude,
no, the cheese fries at this, right? Yeah, they're sort of low class, isn't the right word, but it's sort of, I'm trying to think of it, it's like for the people, like right. The food, like, but yeah, not a lot of people. And then maybe it is because it is alienating to discuss like expensive restaurant meals.
It totally is. And I don't need a podcast to always be like lifestyles of the rich and famous or something. But I do think it's interesting to take a person who, you know, how many times have you talked about like Taco Bell on a podcast before? Right. 1,000, like, and then be like, oh, let's go to this other thing and see what we learn about ourselves and about the experience. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, because fine dining is something I have done. It's not something I always choose to do. And maybe we should lay down the parameters as to what is fine dining. It doesn't necessarily mean expensive, because you can go to but it often is.
Yeah, yeah. Traditionally, fine dining like has a few big tent poles. One is just price, accessibility, you know, if you've got to make reservations, if it feels like the kind of place you'd take somebody for like a quiet New Year's. White tablecloths are also traditionally associated with fine dining, but also I'm sure you grew up in a bunch of fucking redneck Italian places on Long Island that had shitty ass white tablecloths.
Yeah, white tablecloth could mean one of two things. It's a fine dining restaurant or it's a VFW serving shit on a shingle.
Right,
yeah.
So it's one of the two. So yeah, there's no super, super qualifier, and there's different levels within fine dining. You know, there's 11 Madison Park in New York, rated the number one restaurant in the world last year.
Probably peak fine dining.
Right. That is like peak, peak, peak. Multiple courses, multiple hours. Stuff is shaved and foamed and smoked and all that kind of stuff. What we did at 71 Above, there's no white tablecloths. We went for lunch, which makes much more casual experience.
Yeah.
But still, you know, you'd spend well over $100 for two people.
Right. Even for lunch.
Right.
And even
lunch.
With just one drink or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily money, because like you can go to an expensive non-fine dining restaurant, mm-hmm. like you wouldn't call Ink fine dining, even though it like costs a fair amount of money to eat there, and they're doing interesting things. It's about the vibe of the restaurant,
yes.
maybe, and the vibe of fine dining is not necessarily my speed.
Yeah.
But if the food is good, I will fucking wear a blazer or a tie to get to it. You know right. what I mean? Like that I can handle.
Exactly. And a lot of it is service style too. You know, how are you treated? What's the process when you're in the restaurant?
Right.
You know, the truth is I think when we find ourselves as diners uncomfortable in a lot of restaurant circumstances, it's not because the food is bad or that we don't recognize what duck breast is versus chicken breast. It's that like something has happened to make us out of our element. Do you ever like sit down with multiple people and like everybody gets their entree except for you, and then you wait an extra 10 minutes and it sort of just makes everybody uncomfortable because they don't know whether to eat, and
right,
you're like
yeah.
eat, but then they don't. Like
I'm always, by the way, in case anyone listening here ever has a meal with me, feel free to eat, because my thing is when my food comes I'm gonna eat so much faster than you could even imagine, so don't worry about it. I will still finish before you if my food comes 10 minutes
yeah
late, so
but like
stress.
that stuff matters, you know,
right.
the service side really matters. The anecdote I always say, my dad, I grew up in a really small town in northern New York. My dad is a lumber Jack, and like once a month, one town
they
over,
make great breakfast.
They make a huge stack of pancakes every morning. My dad's literally like 5'7 and 140 pounds, and he could kick my ass. And I'm like mad on a lot of levels about it,
because you're the lumberjack.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
genetically a lumberjack.
Yes, I'm,
but chose
I'm 6'2 and 290 or whatever. Like my older brother's 340 and 6'4.
Yeah, you just chose to eat and type.
Yes, exactly. I just found a circumventing where I didn't need to do all the hard work to get to the food. I just went straight to the food. Yeah. I'm the smartest rat in the lab. And that's really it.
No maze for old Farley.
Shoot through enough walls till I got there. But my dad, you know, once a month when we were growing up, he would go a couple towns over to Watertown, New York, and he would eat at the Red Lobster, and he would do it every month. He'd wear a bolero tie, white jeans, and he'd sit in the same section because he knew there was one waiter who worked at this fucking Red Lobster that he loved and would give great service. And when that waiter left to go wherever he went, my dad stopped going to Red Lobster. It was never the Cheddar Bay biscuits. It was just this dude who would treat him like he mattered in a restaurant, you know?
Oh, man, you know, I think you're from a similar area from one of my best friends, because Watertown is right near them.
Oh, yeah. I probably fucking know them.
That's really funny. Former guest of the podcast from the Dead Dads episode, Justin Tyler.
Oh.
Yeah, he is from, he has a house in Lake Sylvia.
Okay.
Great. There. Yeah, go find him, people.
You've got all the clues. Pizzagate 2.0.
It's there, man. Read the emails, dude. What was I just about? I'm screaming about. Oh, yeah. So, like, service, that's one. Now, Red Lobster, is that fine dining to a lumberjack who never goat? Like, is fine dining relative? Like,
yeah, fine dining is absolutely relative.
Because I would say Red Lobster comes across as the classiest of the fast casual places.
Yes, it is certainly a more upscale versus like a Friendly's that is all about like having flair and singing stuff
and Outback
tableside.
Is like, look, it's, you know, wooden tables, everyone's having beers and burgers. Like,
right, exactly.
Red Lobster at least has the air of like you're at a seafood restaurant for whatever it actually may be.
Totally.
Part of their gimmick is that it's like,
and it, I mean, maybe I don't do this anymore. I couldn't tell you the last time I went to a Red Lobster, but you used to go and they let you like pick a lobster out from the tank in the front. If you
I don't
wanted
think that's the
dinner.
Case anymore. I feel like they have lobsters living in like fucking brutal conditions.
Yes, I have to imagine. But it did. It truly felt like something that was, my dad made it a special occasion once a month, you know?
Right.
And so when he came out for my wedding a couple of years ago, I tried to take my whole family to places that I thought were going to be casual enough, like fried chicken, whatever family style things. And I took him to an Italian restaurant here called Alimento in Silver Lake that I really love. And I thought, well, it's just noodles, you know, they'll get it. It's not spaghetti and meatballs, but it's fine. And what I found pretty quickly is that they were actually uncomfortable with the format of dining, that everything was small shared plates. So they'd get a spoon of one thing and a spoon
of
another.
That confuses an older generation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Meanwhile, that's the trend in food, I think, that's helped me enjoy food the most.
Yeah.
Is the small shareable plates. Because when we were first like coming up and first started getting money and first started getting into food, we'd go to restaurants and be like, wouldn't it be fun to just split 8 appetizers instead of having any entrees, and we get to try more things? And then I think restaurateurs are like, what if we serve entrees appetizer sized with entree prices and told these guys it's for sharing? These assholes will buy 5 plates every meal. You're
right.
Like, uh-huh.
And we are catering to a generation of diners that is more and more likely to split and share everything.
Right.
And so I think it really works, at least in the urban markets, you know, places like Atlanta, New York, D.C., L.A. But you get into small communities and it's like, absolutely not. I went back home a few weeks ago and my older brother's like, none of this fucking family style stuff. You want fries? You get your own fries.
I know, like, a lot of people are like, I think I just want to get my own. I don't like someone serving me. Pasta is one of the dishes that I will back some people up on that. Like, I hate to like serve myself a little bit, because 2 bites of pasta doesn't feel like anything.
Right.
But I'll try somebody else's. Yeah.
I'm definitely never splitting a soup. That's that I really got to go my
one
own
soup,
way.
2 straws. it's funny you mentioned the generation of sharing, because my friends that I go out to eat with, and my wife and her friends, we're like, do you want to try a sip of this cocktail? Like, we're like passing around one drink for everyone. Oh, yeah. Ooh, this is good. And there's something about our generation, or at least the people I hang out with, where we'll sit at a restaurant. We'll go to a restaurant we all love and sit there and just keep riffing on other restaurants we've recently been to.
Oh,
that
yeah.
You're like, oh, this is so good. This fried chicken sandwich is great. Have you had Gus's fried chicken? Like, oh, yeah, I love Gus's fried chicken. Their sweet potato pie is awesome. Hey, have you had the sweet potato dessert? Like, all of a sudden we're just like we're doing a pattern game opening of just naming things we've eaten.
Right, right. Which I don't know that much. I think that's what blockchain is. I don't know about
crypto.
Yeah,
I'm not 100% positive.
But I think that's,
I'm pretty sure it's crypto.
Yeah. It's fat people talking about foods in consecutive orders.
If I could make money off that, I would monetize that. All right, yeah.
I'm essentially a food Bitcoin millionaire.
Oh, that's really fun.
Yeah.
That's a smart move.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about the meal a little bit too. Like, 71 Above is a really beautiful place. It's got awesome views of downtown Los Angeles. I also think the food is really good. It's by a chef named Vartan Abgarian, who used to be at a place called Cliff's Edge, but he's been around kind of doing that mid-level dining, like a Bestia or something in Los Angeles, which is energetic food, high prices. It's not fine dining, but you certainly feel like you're going out for a special meal.
And they're trying stuff.
And they're really, really trying interesting stuff. Yeah.
I love Bestia. Bestia's a great example of just like the type of, like, anytime someone visits, like my mother-in-law, whoever, anyone that likes food, we're like, Let's take you to Bestia.
Yeah.
It's going to be expensive. We have to make reservations three months in advance.
Yeah.
But you can wear jeans.
Yeah.
And but it's, and you, when you go there, you're like, wait, this just seems like, and you're like, no, trust me, have the food. And then when you eat the food there, you're like, oh yeah, this is objectively quality.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can not know what you're getting, but still take a bite and be like, yeah, of course it's good.
Yeah. Like, that's what I love about a place like that. When you find a place like that where you're like, oh yeah, it's like impenetrably good. It's like,
exactly. Yeah. And so, I think the format of the lunch that we had was just like basically a quick two course. It's meant to get you out an hour and 25. Right.
But you're assuming it's for anyone who works downtown, comes over here, jumps on the elevator, shoots up 79 floors,
yeah.
71 floors, and then fucking eats.
It's crazy. Yeah. And, but it's such an interesting thing to have like a sliver of seared duck breast for lunch and be like, oh yeah, I'm normally just crushing a quesadilla at this time.
Right. And it feels like you can eat like a not unhealthy, like what did we go? I went with beef tartare as my app and then the roasted half chicken as my entree.
Yeah. And I got the steak as my entree and something else, something vegetable-y to start. But like,
oh no. And yours was good. You got the hamachi.
Oh yeah. I did get the hamachi, but then they sent out the vegetable.
The Brussels
thing.
And the Brussels were kind of the highlight. In
exactly.
A way.
Yeah. And the Brussels are super good.
That's such a smart move on their part. Yeah, they don't know. I mean, they know you're a food person. They don't know who I am, but they're like, send out this app. And then I've been talking about those. I got all my food was good, but I've been talking about that sauce that's on the Brussels the longest. Like, they know.
Yeah.
And Brussels sprouts to me, Brussels are one of those things where I'm just like over it. Like, I feel like it's been too ubiquitous for the last couple of years.
But then you have a good version.
But then
again,
you have a very, and you're like, oh yeah, this isn't bacon and balsamic like everyone else is doing. This is something special. I think you called it a peanut butter vinaigrette or something. Yeah, and I felt that.
It's got that kind of nutty flavor almost with like a sesame oil that you'll get sometimes. Yeah.
It was so good. It was like Thai adjacent because of its peanut sauce. Yeah.
Right.
But a fucking delight. But I will say, I'm not a dessert guy, but, you know, just two giant boys splitting a dessert. The dessert was a true highlight for me.
Yeah.
I never had something like that. I mean, I've had some autumn dessert, you know, exhibit A or whatever. But this one was like, I think, a very good example of that.
Totally. And there's also like, you talk about getting pegged when you walk in the room, but there's a certain type of restaurant in Los Angeles and other cities that has a vested interest in knowing who I am, because I write about restaurants all day long, and you know, we're a big publication, and so we can drive a lot of traffic to places if somebody makes the right impression or something like that. But I'm truly also just a guy who's like large in a room eating, and I'm sure they're like, oh yeah, don't send out the fucking sorbet. These guys can smell a watermelon water from a mile away. Give them the autumn thing. Yeah. Like,
that was awesome. So it was like sweet potato with spicy marshmallow. It was like sweet potato tart with spicy marshmallow and then burnt cinnamon ice cream, which was like kind of the highlight for me.
Unreal.
It really reminded me a little bit of the only other, like, I'm not a big dessert guy, but every once in a while I have a dessert that really stands out. And Animal has that bacon chocolate bar with salt and pepper ice cream, which I think is like one of the highlights of a
like
dessert.
A day one dish. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, it's true. Their menu changes so often, but that's one of like the eight things that's always there. I can close my eyes, I think, and read the Animal menu. That's how often I've eaten. I mean, you see my proximity to it.
Yes.
It's exactly like a half mile walk from my door to, or as I like to say it, one large joint. If I walk out of my house, light a joint, by the time I'm turning onto Fairfax, I'm putting it out, walking directly into Animal high as fuck and going ham on some fucking poutine.
Burning in the face of some teenager waiting for Supreme to open.
I'm literally get eyeballed all the time by all the dudes waiting for Supreme because they're like, this guy reeks more like weed than we do. And he's an adult. Allegedly.
Yeah, I really love changing a teenager's perception of what an adult can be just by being yourself.
Right. Yeah. You're like, no, I woke up at one today.
Yeah.
I'm married.
Yeah, marriage is like completely different, and also look at my life still. It's totally fine.
Yeah, I always tell people that. I'm like, trust me, you can live a shitty life. Because that's the thing, a lot of people are nervous about getting married, that they can't do the thing they do. And I'm like, well, the trick is to not have a day job while your wife has a day job.
Yes, that's 100%
true. I live a full different life from like 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And as you can tell, I mean, this is why you get certain texts from me when you decide to go to fine dining with me. I'm like, hey, is this like a shirt and tie place or like a shirt? Because as you can see, this is what I'm in daily.
Yeah.
Hemp shoes, sweats, and a sweatshirt.
Hemp shoes.
I know. I've got hemp slides on. In case you're wondering if I'm chasing the dude's lifestyle as much as possible.
What were those like multicolored like pullover hoodies that like weed guys
the
would wear?
Or drug rugs.
Yeah, the drug rugs. You're the guy who's like, I can't not wear hemp, but I know that those are socially unacceptable.
Right, right.
Let me go to the shoes.
I wanted one of those Bajas so bad, and specifically in like a pinkish color.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw one down on Alameda. Is that like
yes.
a little... and I was chasing it, but of course, because they're made by Mexican people for Mexican people, nothing fit me.
Of course.
I'm like, do you have anything in a double X? They're like, we have this one, and it's just like a black hoodie. They're like, we don't make it. Usually people your size don't want to stand out.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Look at this guy. He's like a walking ad for a kidney replacement center. No, it's just the pink Baja.
Slap a giant Baja on this fuck. What other fine dining experiences have you enjoyed? Because I think we've both eaten at Providence, right?
Yeah, I've done all the LA ones. I've done Providence. I've done Melisse.
Which one's Melisse?
Melisse is out in Santa Monica. It's Josiah Citrin's place. Oh. I actually think it's kind of the most interesting out of the traditional fine dining restaurants of Los Angeles because they're only a couple of blocks off the ocean. Josiah is like a really laid back dude, surfer guy who's been doing this kind of casual fine dining restaurant for years. And when you go in now, there's a lot of old folks who like are sitting in the corner booth and want their anniversary. But now there's also this whole generation of like young Asian mainlanders who have money from their family and are coming over to the United States to spend it. And they will just run a table 10 deep and they know all the good stuff. They want the truffles. They want foie gras. They want like good old bottles of wine.
And yeah, so I'm seeing like a lot of young Asian people anecdotally stereotyping. But I've seen a lot of young Asian people who are heavy into food.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like they are at the place that is like it makes me think and I'm not trying to blow smoke up your own ass, but like there are people in other countries reading Eater or Jonathan Gold, you
right,
know, like
right.
who are like when we go to L.A., I trust these places because like you'll see them at like you'll see a group of Asian tourists be at like a restaurant that you've like, you know, is pretty, like they'll be mm-hmm. at Son of a Gun or something, you know,
yeah,
and you're like,
yeah.
How'd you hear about this? And then they're like ordering the fried chicken sandwich and they know what to order. And you're
yeah.
like, oh shit, dudes, you guys are, and then here I am, I go to Barcelona. And if you don't think I have like a fucking page of recommendations,
right.
I watch Phil's episode on Barcelona.
Yep.
I watch Bourdain's Barcelona
right.
and I'm like all geared up, ready to go. I'm like, oh, it's so small minded of me to not assume people from
are doing it the other
yeah,
way.
Doing it the other way around.
Yeah. And what we're also forgetting too is that, you know, Los Angeles is a city, the metro population is 12, 13 million. We're only 22% white.
Right.
So there are 2 million mainland first, second generation Chinese people living in the San Gabriel Valley right now who have almost no interest in going to downtown to eat because they can get better versions of things from their home communities right in their neighborhoods in La Puente and La Habra and stuff like that.
Oh, where did I go in San Gabriel with I went to Elite Cuisine.
Yeah.
Oh, so fucking good.
That's great.
It was fucking awesome.
I've been
yeah.
trying to do like dim sum Sundays with friends of mine and just like get the carts, go bring 12 folks and just like crush it.
Oh, dude, yeah, that sounds like a solid Sunday.
It's so, and you walk out and it's like $13 a person. Like it's comical.
It's crazy the way it works too. Like
yeah.
you're just like pointing at pictures on a menu. You know, it's, I love going to a place in America that makes me feel uncomfortable in a good way of like, I don't think anyone here speaks English.
Yeah.
I don't think they care, you know? And I'm like just pointing at stuff and they're like, yeah. Uh-huh, okay, you know, Gaijin, here you go.
I just got back over the weekend from the Valle de Guadalupe, which is Mexico's largest wine producing region. It's up Baja Norte. So it's just south of Tijuana by about an hour, hour and a half. And most of the wine that they produce stays in Mexico because, especially for California, import laws are such that they want to keep the wine producing region of California stronger than they would Mexico.
Right.
And so you can go down there and just hop from winery to winery. There's these beautiful outdoor restaurants. We had a place called Finca Altozano, which is a really famous restaurant by a chef named Javier Plasencia. Javier comes from a family in Tijuana that is like restaurant royalty. They own a restaurant down there that I couldn't tell you the name of off the top of my head, but they like literally created the Caesar salad. Like it's that kind of old school family thing.
Oh, that's awesome.
But you eat at this place, Finca Altozano, and it's these beautiful views of the valley, and you can't believe that you're so lucky to be there. And I went on a tour with a bunch of friends, and so we'd all prepaid in advance for dinner, but if you want to drink, drinks. It was extra. And I was like, listen, I'll pay for it on my card. Everybody just Venmo me at the end. And we got bottles of wine and cocktails and beer and drinks. And it was $150 to put, and that's like one bottle of wine, maybe two if you're feeling thrifty at a restaurant in Los Angeles.
Yeah, dude. That. And did you like rent like a van or something?
Yeah,
like
we had a 16-person van. And we do a stop in Tijuana. We had one of my favorite places in Tijuana called Tacos Aron. And it's this like morning birria. So it's like stewed goats that they stew overnight. And then they put in these tortillas. And you can get them crisped up if you want to. So they're like Tacos Dorado style, like crunchy. And then they give you consomme on the side, which is basically all the stuff that they're stewing it in and braising it in overnight. It's just in a cup with cilantro and onions. You just drink it. And it's a little bit spicy. Oh,
that sounds fucking awesome.
It's the perfect hangover cure.
I'm going to have to set up one of these trips with
my
friends.
Anytime you want to go, it's so fun.
Yeah, this sounds like a blast. Because we're big wine country people. But like we don't want to go all the way up to NorCal. We go to Los Olivos like quarterly. But I think that might be a good mix-up.
Yeah, and it's fine. Like, and there's the group that I went with. I've been going through them for years. It's called Club Tango Hombre. They have another one in Mexico City. And they'll just take people on tours. A lot of it is in-country folks, like Mexican, intra-Mexican tourism. And then they'll just also let people walk over the border. They got a bus on the Tijuana side. They pick you up. There's mezcal on the bus. And you're just like rolling. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to drive.
So it's like food tourism.
Yeah, essentially.
Oh, that's so awesome. Is there stuff like that in LA? There's gotta be,
for
I'm
sure.
assuming. Because that's the shit that really, that's the shit that, like, I know a guy, Scott Wiener in New York, who runs Scott's Pizza Tours.
Right.
And he's like connected to all the good pizza guys around New York. And the tours leave and go to three places in mainland Manhattan. And then on the weekends, they hit one outer borough.
Oh, nice.
And one of the tours for a while was running through Gravesend, Brooklyn, which is like deep Brooklyn, far from Manhattan, where a dude was cooking, a guy who owned a pizzeria. It was pretty famous. I forget his name now. But he was cooking pizza out of a pizza oven in his backyard. And the bus would stop by every Saturday, and he would have pizzas made for everyone.
Dude, I love
that's
that.
Such a cool, I love shit like that. So that's so cool to know. Of course that exists.
Yeah.
But when you in your head, like being fucking classist, be like, well, that doesn't happen in Mexico. Like, you get on a bus here in Los Angeles, pay $1,000, and they drive. But of course, that exists.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. All you basically for this tour, all you have to do is make it to the border by 9 a.m. So, we had parents who drove down from LA early in the morning. We had friends who stayed at Airbnbs or stayed at a hotel in San Diego. The train will take you right there.
Oh, right,
and then
right.
you just walk across the border, get on the bus, and it's all day, and they drop you back off at night. It's a one day tour.
Oh, that sounds fucking great.
Yeah. But to your point about this backyard pizza guy, there's a real huge scene of like underground food here in Los Angeles as well, not just street stuff that you see every day walking around.
You actually posted something recently that Phil had talked to me about, that burger place.
Burgers
that's
Never
like
Say Die.
Yeah. I gotta try that.
Dude, anytime you wanna go, it's fun. It's really, really fun. I went a couple of weeks ago, and not to blow up too many spots, but like where this guy is situated, it's his house, and he parks a burger setup in his driveway and just cooks all day. But they try to keep it a little bit off street. So he's got a car at the front of his driveway, so you can't really see him. But he's situated right at the end of a grocery store. And if you parked at the far end of the grocery store, you just walk over to this guy's house. And I pull into that spot, and there's a McLaren over there, and I'm like, yo, somebody is here. And it's Tyler the Creator eating a burger with like a bunch of other famous people and Robert Pattinson from like the Twilight movies. And they're all just hanging out and friends eating burgers.
I'll take this opportunity to maybe say to shout out also possibly from my favorite 2017 movie, Good Time.
Oh,
if you haven't seen that yet, Pattinson's in it, and he's a true actor.
Ooh, I gotta watch it.
He's not, to me, he's no longer, what's his name?
Edward,
yes, Edward Cullen. He's now, to me, like he's so good in Good Time. I think it's the best movie of the year.
Nice. Did you see The Rover?
No.
He's in The Rover from a couple of years ago, and he's really fantastic.
I think he's shaking off his vampire days, and he's demonstrating that he's a solid act. Oh, dude, it's funny that you bring up Tyler the Creator now that we've also talked about Fairfax, which is where I see Tyler the Creator weekly.
Every day. Yeah.
He's just like that's what I love about LA is that like there is that element of like there are mega famous people that live here, but they do also have to live a life.
Yeah.
So like there's like an element to that of just like, oh, I was standing outside of Animal the other night, and Tyler the Creator was kick flipping down the line. You know,
right.
He was like skating with his boys earlier.
I've been in John and Vinny's on Fairfax when Kanye West walked in for a pickup order, and it's like, oh yeah, Kanye West eats pizza.
Of course he does.
And
yeah.
He fucking probably reads Eater. Because like we want to blow up John and Vinny's as the next cool spot as much as anybody else, and he figures out how to get there, like, for sure. The greatest example, and this ties back to the, we're talking about mainland Asian people coming and spending their money here. There's an underground barbecue place called Trudy's Underground Barbecue. And it's this guy who's like a 50-year-old Israeli dude who smokes, I think, the best Texas-style barbecue in his backyard in Studio City. He does, you know, he doesn't need the money. He's got a family of his own, three daughters running around, but he makes incredible barbecue because he cares. And the way that, like, I found out about this guy pretty early on, wrote a story, he started getting a little bit more traction, now he's got whatever 20,000 Instagram followers, and you gotta DM him on Instagram to get this stuff. So a couple, a young couple from Thailand, read my article, found this guy on Instagram, started following him for a year before they came to the States. They DM'd him on a day that I happened to be in this guy's backyard just hanging out with him, and they were like, hey, we just landed, can we come get barbecue? And he's like, yeah, come on up. So this couple, they're 22, fresh off the boat, first time they've ever been to America, are on in an Uber on their way to eat backyard barbecue from this guy. And the crazy kicker is he wasn't just doing regular Texas style barbecue that day. He had made like a pastrami style beef rib. So he brined it and all, you know, for days and then smoked it. And so this couple showed up like wide eyed, and you have to explain to them like what underground food is, what Texas style barbecue is, what the pastrami version of Texas style underground barbecue is.
If they leave and that's their idea of like American food, it's like, yeah, you eat in someone's backyard and it's like Jewish Southern, right, you know, meat. Right. That's so funny.
And it's the Wild West. Yeah. Oh. But that's also true in my book. You know, I uncover a lot of these old letters and dispatches where people would come to Los Angeles in the 1880s and talk about how they thought that there were no indoor restaurants because there were so many people selling street food even back then that you never made it to the second level of the sit down restaurant. You just would eat everything off the streets.
We really harness our good weather in that way.
Yes.
In that, like, even like restaurants that aren't like Jitlada is an indoor restaurant, but it's always so slow and right, so packed that 40 people could be just milling around.
Yep.
And it's not pouring on them or freezing on you. You know, you can, yeah, wait in line for Hal and Ray's. You can stand outside Cactus Taco waiting, uh-huh, on your fucking pastor. Like, it allows you to do so much, the fancy weather here. And you forget that.
Yeah, you really, I mean, even when it's like cold, it's crisp, but perfectly bright and cloudless.
Right. Like, you wouldn't want to be in like Brooklyn in late January waiting in line an hour for some sort of nouveau pizza joint.
Right.
You'd fucking be like, fuck this. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to New Orleans next week. And it's talk about a fucking food city. But that, the weather there will turn on a dime. And if you are not like footwear and umbrella prepared, fuck waiting for anything outside.
Oh no, fuck that. Yeah. Oh shit, dude. I can't wait for you. I'm so jealous. My wife just the other day randomly said to me, she goes, we need a New Orleans trip. I was like, yo, we have no money. We just got back from Europe. We just spent 11 days in Europe over Christmas. We have no money. Pump the brakes on this New Orleans shit.
But
you, frozen Irish iced coffee from Aaron Rose Cafe is maybe the best beverage I've ever had in, yeah, my entire life.
Have you done like Little Jewel of New Orleans down here in Chinatown in Los Angeles?
No.
It's like a deli, really casual, doing New Orleans food, poor boys and stuff. It's like, you know, it'll get you 80% of the way there. Like, if you guys are tight on money for 6 months or to like you do want to just wait, go there and be like, oh, I'm a little satisfied.
Yeah,
and
okay,
then I can
cool,
plan it later.
Cool,
yeah.
Cool. Yeah. New, like, I'm realizing more and more that some of my favorite things, like, I love food that tastes good,
mm-hmm,
but I also really like vibes. And like, I'm finding more and more that TV shows and movies and restaurants that I really like put out a certain vibe. And,
yeah,
and often the vibe isn't like, at least if they're trying to get that vibe, I'm not detecting the effort. So like, that's important. But like, New Orleans has just, the city as its whole is like, you just get off and you're like, yeah, a lot of people are too in the vibe, but the other 90%
lost
of them,
in the sauce.
Yeah, there's just some people who are a little, you know, a little have gone full Colonel Kurtz of like adapting to the current lifestyle of New Orleans, but the rest, everyone is just like, you know, three quarters buzzed and, yeah, enjoying themselves. And it just really permeates the entire vibe, like the entire country, city.
Yeah. We, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles now are going to go play in the Super Bowl here in a couple of weeks. And all the news articles, as soon as they were starting to win, is that there's a patrol specifically designated for the city to go out and put Crisco on lampposts.
Right.
So that like dudes can't climb up and wreak havoc. And I was like, I kind of wish I lived in a city like that. Like, I want a little more of that in my city than I currently get.
My friend Joe Wingard is from, you know, Joe, from Philly, and he's he said, win or lose, I will not survive the city. It's like, it doesn't matter if Philly wins or loses, shit's going down in Philadelphia in 2 weeks, no matter what.
Right, right.
This is a really hard Super Bowl for me as a Giants fan. It's like two arch nemeses squaring off.
Yeah, you really want no one to succeed.
Yeah, I think I'm going to maybe root for the Pats.
I think you have to.
Just because they have enough Super Bowls that it's like, what's one more?
Right.
You know what I mean?
And where, you still get to hang that, like, we're the only ones to beat them.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But I think it's anybody's game, which terrifies me. But Tom Brady is, and I'll kick my own ass for saying this, but Tom Brady's fucking good at football.
Yeah. He's sacrificed literally every other aspect of his life.
Yeah, to personality.
Like, yeah, to earn money and football accolades. Yeah. But like, people can do that. I've sacrificed a good bit of my life to eat food. Like,
right, yeah. I mean, if you're sacrificing a lot of stuff in life to be maybe the best football player currently and to fuck Giselle, like, I think... I think you got it okay. You know, I'm not going right. to feel sympathy anytime soon for Mr. Brady.
Oh, this poor guy. Yeah, but to your point about vibes, like, this goes back to the fine dining thing. Sometimes these places just represent themselves as too stuffy. You know, yeah. I want to be able to, like, be a boisterous character. I want to be able to laugh. I want to not have to, like, fucking pretend that I know every technique that's gone into this persimmon that you've, like, dehydrated, rehydrated, smoked, and crumbled. It can be okay for it to just be food sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. But there is a movement away from that. Stuffiness is sort of coming away from restaurants because I think they realize, yes, there are old moneyed people who want to spend money on restaurants, but they're the real, at least in these cities, in my experience, like New York, Brooklyn, and New York and LA and stuff, the people who are spending money at these restaurants are the 25 to 40 year olds who don't have kids and have money, or have kids but got the babysitter for the night to try Night Market song or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. There's a lot of what's happening in the restaurant industry sort of mirrors America, where it's haves and have nots. The kind of middle is cratering. So 40 seat neighborhood restaurants that offer good food at a casual price point are fewer and fewer far between. You know, Bestia is a big property, but it being so busy and so casual still is kind of the exception that proves the rule. Most other places are starting to really, really feel that pinch.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so places like Vespertine here in Culver City, like, you know, it was $2,000 for four people to eat. Like, that restaurant is ethereal and odd and very expensive and will get to exist on its own in the same way that, like, a proliferation of food halls get to exist on its own, where the middle starts to have problems.
Right, right, right. Vespertine is the one that's like, that one's like a full, like a day experience, right?
Yeah. My meal was 5.5 hours. They described the building as a spaceship from a different planet in time. They described the cuisine as something that has never been before conceived. I've asked the chef in person, like, does this restaurant have any heart at its base? Like, we all use these grandmother terms to describe cooking.
Yeah. You love hearing the story is like, I grew up on a certain, and I just trying to chase the comfort I would feel.
Right.
Eating larb at grandma's house.
Like, you with weed in Brazil, I'm assuming.
Yeah, give me a joint and a chicken parm. That's why John and Vinny's have a fucking, their restaurant's not too far from here either.
Yeah.
And they have a direct, like, crossbow that it shoots from their restaurant directly into my heart, where it's like, we've got chicken parm where the edges are a little crispy and it's super hammered out thin, and you're high right now. And it's like, I am. And they're like, that was maybe the best chicken parm I've had since coming out west. John and Vinny's chicken parm.
Yeah,
holy shit.
We just don't have the strong Italian component like you do back east. You know, there's no Little Italy in Los Angeles.
Right, that's like the only thing that's missing out here. And deli culture.
Yes.
That's the thing that I miss the most. I mean, again, it's so hard to have a conversation about New York and LA and not feel like, I've been living here now for over 5 years.
Right.
But the shit where, that's like, those are the two things that they don't have out here. And it's, and I mean, bagels.
Yeah.
But it's not enough to dismiss the city anymore. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's so much more than pizza in this world.
Yes, exactly. And I can find pretty good versions of most of those things. The one thing I think that I really, really feel East Coast versus West Coast is the lack in Los Angeles of a sustained Greek food community.
You know, you have to get, like, you have to go Greek adjacent into like Mediterranean, Middle Eastern to try to get like only a handful of places have gyro meat. They'll have shawarma, but they won't have gyro.
Right, right. Yeah. And we do like Lebanese and Armenian food like nobody's fucking business, but like old school Greek, modern Greek places, they don't really exist. Like the versions we have, you ever been to Papa Christos?
Yes.
Yeah, Papa Christos is like a guy whose name is literally Chris S. Chris. He's 4'8" maybe. He just has like huge mustache. Every time you see a photo of him, he's got the big belly, both arms out. Hey! And that's just who he is. And you can go to his place and get spanakopita and things like that, but it's all just kind of casual and nobody really cares.
He has the spices though. He makes those spices because I have some friends that swear by Papa Christos seasonings.
Yeah. But that whole, it used to be called the Byzantine Latino Quarter. It was a vastly and densely Greek neighborhood for a long time, and now it's a mix of Central Americans and Koreans, and the Greeks have all basically left for the suburbs.
Yeah, weird. That's another one I guess I never even noticed wasn't around, you know?
Yeah.
And there is also a lack of diners, which are traditionally a Greek-owned business.
Yeah. But I've heard, you know, you go to Astoria and it's just like you throw a rock and hit a great Greek restaurant, or at least a half-decent one.
Right, yeah. Well, that's what I always thought too, like, you know, a friend of mine just moved here from New York, and last night she's like, but where are the slice joints out here? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, you're right. There's not that many. But, you know, you're in your 30s. You don't need to eat slices of pizza anymore.
And
like,
also,
there's like other food out here. And I fucking, trust me, when I go to New York, if I don't grab a fucking slice at some point, you know, I will, of course.
Yeah. You know where your slice places are here? They're masquerading as taco trucks and they're better.
Yeah, like, right? Yeah. And switch from a pizza to a fucking couple of tacos and you'll be happy.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I think there's a lot of good pizza in Los Angeles and it varies in style, but I'll take the proliferation of Mexican food over anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan. I think the thing that people forget is that like in New York there's gonna be great pizza places in LA, but in New York it's like the median slice of pizza is decent, like that's the thing, and it's like three on every block, and at the worst one you're gonna have is gonna be like, well, that was a pretty solid slice. And that's how I feel about like delis and sandwiches in New York too, where it's like on any corner you can get a fucking ham and cheese on a roll or whatever, or a ham, egg and cheese, or you know, a Italian combo. In LA, it's like, where am I going to get that? And if you can just shift that from like you know, like just make breakfast at home in LA, or like just buy a juice. If you can switch from bacon, egg, and cheese and a coffee to something else, you can live here. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But I understand, like, that's something you just get so accustomed to. Like, in the last few years, had to adapt to just making coffee at home, which is really not a problem.
Right.
And way more financially viable and actually more convenient than having to like bundle up and walk and go buy a coffee. Not that you bundle up here, but I'm just not that close to coffee shops around here. Like, I'm close where it's like, oh, I can go hang out, have a cup of coffee. But like in New York, it'd be like, I'll be back in 5 minutes with my coffee and breakfast and be ready to go.
Yeah. And it's all just like post-consumer product that's going to immediately get thrown in the trash, but you're just like, whatever, it's at arm's length as soon as I left my building.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot more that goes into it here, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I also think that that's, for me, as a guy who covers the food scene in Los Angeles, that's value added because I want to be exploring places that other people aren't touching that much. If you take South LA, which is roughly defined as the neighborhood just south of the 10 here, before you get to like the complete South Bay or Long Beach, square miles-wise, it's larger than the entire island of Manhattan.
Right.
And, you know, maybe two stories a week on Eater, I write six stories a day, will be about South LA, to say nothing of any other publication. And there is an underserved demographic there that is eager to have quality conversations about the same stuff that they're already eating.
Right.
So, you know, I don't mind that I don't have a great Creole or Cajun restaurant near me because it gives me the opportunity to go eat that stuff in a place I wouldn't normally be.
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of with you on that, where it's like, then go seek it out.
If
it's not in your neighborhood, that's fine. Go seek it out, or move to a neighborhood that has the exact food you needed to have. But that sounds insane.
Yeah.
That is a huge area. Cause that's where, as someone who's currently interested in real estate, is like, that's where I still can't afford it, but mm-hmm. that's where I could foreseeably afford to buy a place is
totally.
Below the 10,
yeah.
which kind of buries you away from everything you have to do if you're a UCB person or like
yeah.
and having podcast guests over to your house when you say you live below the 10 and they all live in Atwater
yeah,
is a little tough. It's a little tough. But I'm looking at and it's like, yeah, wait, drive down there and there's a lot of houses and some businesses, but then you're like, this is going to be popping off
yeah.
soon. As soon, like the second there's an influx of money and into that neighborhood, people are going to be, the second gentrification starts, I guess. I mean, there's good restaurants there already, but they're going to start seeking out those properties.
It's totally. Like, yeah. Totally. You know, you have Daniel Patterson from San Francisco. His restaurant group Alta is putting a restaurant in West Adams just south of the 10. That's going to be a beautiful fine dining, kind of finer dining all day component with a cafe attached. You know, there's a lot that's happening down that way. The first place I ever lived in Los Angeles was on Slauson, like in the real thick of it, you know, and
yeah.
We just wrote a story about a place called Simply Wholesome down there that's been around for, I think, 33 years, doing kind of South LA's version of healthy food and how it's a real crux for the Black community there. And it's like fascinating stuff. So I don't think that while gentrification is going to be an issue and already is an issue for many parts of Los Angeles, I think you're going to see that community stand up the way that Boyle Heights has stood up and just say, you can take some of it, but we need to keep our cultural identity intact.
Yeah. And that's fucking great. Cool. Yeah, yeah. That's the move. That's the way to do it is like, we'll take your influx of money and tax payments for this area and yeah. you know, whatever, but you're not closing down. Not everything here is going to be an Erewhon or
right,
whatever.
Right. Yeah. And we've all got to learn to be good neighbors. Cause I bought a house relatively recently and we were looking in Boyle Heights and I love Boyle Heights. I spent a lot of my time in Boyle Heights. I speak a little Spanish. Boyle Heights is under no obligation to love me back, you know? Right. And I could buy my home that I would choose to live in off of a lovely old couple who actually wanted to sell because their house was suddenly worth a lot more money than what they paid for and be doing everybody a service in the neighborhood. But it's about more than that. It's about what I represent being on the block as a guy who's wearing fucking styled out throwback Reeboks and a green button up. Like right. You gotta be willing to take the larger picture.
Yeah, no, it's so true. There is like that weird tip of the gentrification spear thing where yeah. you're like, I'm here under good auspices, I promise. And they're like, I don't care. You're white and I know what comes next.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to move.
Yeah, there's a place in Boyle Heights called Weird Wave Coffee that it was run by a Venezuelan dude and a couple of white guys. And they were well-meaning enough, but didn't really have the wherewithal to... Oh, shit, secret guest, dude. They didn't really have the wherewithal to talk more openly and honestly with the community before they opened up. They just thought, oh, Weird Wave, we're kind of at the fringes of what's cool. And it's like, yo, man, you cannot talk about like discovering anything when you were in Boyle Heights. The most like traditionally Hispanic and prior to that Jewish neighborhood, one of the oldest neighborhoods in all of Los Angeles.
Right, right.
And so they just got like fucking bricks put through their window because they, as a coffee shop, without the right dialogue up front, represent everything that's bad about what's happening.
Right, right.
Yeah.
A high-end weird coffee shop, literally with weird in the yeah, title, is right. like is the parody version of what gentrifies a neighborhood.
Yep, 100%.
Like, of what is disliked. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a dude who a couple of years ago started a downtown taco truck called White Boy Tacos. It's like a little cart on the street. And it's like, White Boy Tacos, okay, I'm like whatever on the name. But in his like Yelp description that he gets to write for himself, he's like, yeah, I just discovered there's no good tacos in downtown Los Angeles, so I thought I would come in. I'm like, let me stop you right there, buddy.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
I gotta geez. Stop you.
Yeah, don't let anyone else hear you say that.
Right, right.
Yeah. White Boy Tacos just made me think of, I ate at a food truck in Austin that was sort of like shawarma wraps one mm-hmm. time. And it mm-hmm. was just like, do you want it spicy? I'm like, a little bit spicy. And they're like, well, and they point to their spice chart and it just says white people spicy. It says no spice, white people spicy, brown people spicy. Those are the three choices.
Great.
I was like, I'll take white people spicy. They're like, smart move.
Yeah, yeah. And it was exactly what you wanted,
I
bet.
Exactly what I wanted. I was like, yeah. Yes. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Have you done the hot chicken at Holland Race in Chinatown?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
I went and saw the line after eating. We were chasing a General Tso's, one of my first meals with Phil and Zach Brooks and mm-hmm. that crew. I went down there and we ate at a Chinese food place. It was really good. I forget what they were known for. Something
Yang
like,
Chow, maybe the slippery shrimp?
The slippery shrimp. Yep. Yep. Once I said I knew it was like a weird sexually suggestive seafood dish, slippery shrimp was yeah. what it was. And then we went over to get coffee in that little compound and I was yep. like, oh my God, Howlin' Rays. I'd want to get in line right now.
Yeah.
I got to do it. I got to do it at
yeah,
some point.
Yeah, we'll do it soon. It's very good, but they've got six or seven different spice levels and like the triple X like Howlin' level is it's not fun. Like it's it's actually a bummer. Yeah.
Right. I think some of those exist just solely to be like, fuck you if you want this. Yeah,
and there are people, Danny Chow, who's a great writer, he writes for The Ringer now, he does a lot of food stuff. He's a dude who grew up like eating bird's eye peppers by the fucking handful because his family would like just feed them to him as a kid. And so for him, like the XXX Howlin' is like nothing, but a guy like me, it's like, can I get medium plus?
Or that'll like, fuck up my whole day.
Yeah, that shit'll just ruin my life.
I'm usually ordering spiciness the same way I order wine, one up from bottom barrel.
There
like,
you go.
You know, it's like, what's the cheapest wine? I'll take the second cheapest. What's the one that's one above not spicy?
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Yeah. When the sommelier walks by and all you want to do is talk price.
Yeah. It's
he's like all right, this what, fucking
are we
table.
Looking 50 or 60? Sir, tell the truth. Don't you fuck me on this. are you, I mean, because a lot of your food, at least from the articles I've read of yours in the book, it's like, you know, it's a lot of street food, not so much fine dining. How much does like how much fine dining or how much eating goes along with like beverages? You know what I mean? Like, because it's hard not to like in my head, you go out to dinner, you have a like even at lunch and I'm trying not to drink that much in January at lunch. It was like I almost did the wine pairing.
Yeah,
it's two courses.
Yeah.
I almost went, I'll two glasses of wine right now. I'm like, I Ubered. I'm like, you know, maybe I shouldn't do that. But I was like, how much of that do you have to like try drinks? I'm just curious because that would be my reviews would all be like, I smoked a joint right outside before I went in there. I had four beers and a couple of Jariscos.
Yeah.
And the Alpes store is fantastic. People are like, Jesus, we can't trust your review.
I barely remember it. Yeah. You know, it depends like... most of the time, if I'm going to a restaurant, say unannounced, and I'm just having dinner by myself, whatever, I stick to the food. I'll maybe get a cocktail if they have a full cocktail bar. Wine, I try to not do unless it's for a particular occasion, just because it all adds up. Like I'm doing, you
know, like if you're eating two meals out a day,
right,
7 days a week,
right,
you can't have 14 glasses.
Yeah,
of wine.
Exactly. Even if I just have one glass every place, it's like too much. Plus, on the nights that I happen to be home with my wife or want to catch a drink with a friend, like all that stuff adds up too. So,
right, because sometimes you want to have a meal for fun.
Right. Yeah. So, like if it's a particular place that has a bar and I haven't been there before and I want to check it out, I'll get a cocktail just to kind of see if they're doing the classics well, what kind of fun stuff they might have. But I try not to do too much of that stuff. I haven't been like drunk at a restaurant in a long time, which is it comes with the territory. I wouldn't want to make a fool of myself or something, you know?
Right, because you may have to be back there for work or they might have to be like, so-and-so from Eater was in here last night fucking stumbling around.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I'm already very aware of like I try to wear a version of this same outfit every day. I would just want to be a fucking Dilbert cartoon so that like nobody notices me as much as possible. And I'm very aware of the perception when people meet me for the first time of them going like, oh, that's what he looks like or something
right,
like that,
right,
that I don't want to add being a fucking sloppy drunk asshole on top of that.
Right. Hey, yeah, sure. This is good food you got here. All right. See you later.
Somebody got to plunge that toilet.
Yeah. That's the last thing you need is like you write an article and then the first comment is like, I saw this guy eating there. He was a shit show.
Right. Yeah, like, exactly.
Oh, sorry.
Exactly right. My best case scenario for like getting the information before anybody else in this business is to know people, be nice, and do a good job.
Right.
And if I'm losing on one of those three because I come off as an asshole or a drunk, no way.
What made you get into food this much?
Well, there's a couple different levels to it. Like the base level is I moved to LA doing comedy stuff and I really liked it and I was super dead broke, and so I would drive my motorcycle back down to Slauson every night and I would stop at a new taco place because for $5 you could eat like a king. And then I'm type A enough that I'm like, oh, let's go to a couple. Okay, let's go to 5, let's go to 20. And I went to 125 in my first year, and I used to have a Google map and I'd put little pins down for what I liked and stuff.
You were just keeping track of little carts and
trucks
that you were like, actually this place has the better carnet, you know?
Right,
like,
right. And then you'd hear from people, oh, if you like that place, you got to go to this place. Then I'd drive out farther and farther. And I my friend Brett, who was my roommate at the time, was like totally down to go out and eat with me. We'd hit 3 or 4 places in a night. Oh, we like this, we like that more, whatever. And eventually I got to the point where I was getting a little bit of money doing comedy stuff, coaching improv, things like that, and getting a little bit of money writing about food. I still had a day job. They realized I could leave my day job and do both. But then once I was only doing both, it was like, well, what's the most most fun thing. Like,
right.
I'd gotten on Herald Night and I was doing that, but I was never the guy who's like, I want to get the best manager. I want to go be in every audition. I would hear dudes doing an audition that I was sitting in the waiting room for better than I knew I was capable of doing. I hear them through the door. I'm like, why the fuck am I here? Like, and
you're like,
the,
I would book him too.
Right, right. I'd pick my resume back up off the desk and go, yeah, hire that guy.
I'm going to save all of us time and I'm going to go get some tacos.
Right. And then every comedy person that I knew, when they found out I knew enough about tacos or something, they would be like, oh, you tell me, give me your information.
Yeah.
So all I really started doing was just monetizing information that I already had. And then I was able to do that enough to make a full-time living. And now it's great. Like, there's not that many people who do what I do for a living in Los Angeles. It's maybe four of us, five, right, full-time money writing about restaurants. But like, the pool of people that are also trying to do it is way smaller than a UCB or trying to make it
an entertainment.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's like the top level. The other level is like, what do I really want? I want people to like me and think that I'm interesting. And as like an always fat kid, can I just eat free food as like a part of that equation? Sure.
My like first performances as a child were like, look how much I can eat.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yep. Would be like at the soccer car wash eating 12 slices of pizza at like 14 years old and everyone being like, holy shit, Gabrus is a machine. And I'm like, attention. Yes. Attention. Yes.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I one of my earliest like on stage memories, I was like in 4-H as a little kid. And
oh,
I,
me too.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
That's really funny. One week every summer, I went to 4-H camp in yeah. Riverhead, Long Island.
I got to go to the National 4-H Convention in Maryland, and it was a whole week, and we were there the whole time. And at the end, they did this thing where it was like a series of little games and challenges that they did on stage. And they took all the leftover breakfast food, and they blended it up, and they put it in these three buckets, and you're supposed to like, look like slop, and you're supposed to reach in, and like the first one to find this pin won a prize. And I was on stage, and the guy next to me found a pin, and he was getting all the applause, and so I took my hand out full of this breakfast slop and I licked it from elbow to fingertip being like, it's just breakfast stuff, it's gotta be fine. And you have never seen a room turn against you as quickly as that, because people are like, that gets fucking disgusting. And I had to like drippy hand walk off stage, but I thought I would get some sort of praise for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't want to take the wind out of your sails here, but trust me, I've seen a room turn against me. I don't want to also misrepresent me. I've had whole rooms turn against me in the blink of an eye, right, as well. Something right. I'm well versed in, unfortunately. Sometimes intentional, sometimes wildly unintentional. Yep,
exactly.
See, that's really, I think honestly, the bravest, one of the like boldest things you could do career wise is choose to go into show business, because it's so inevitably not going to work out.
Right.
But I think one notch more bold than that is deciding to leave.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
There is something, and there is like this weird thing of just like, when I feel like it's like those war movies when guys are on their like fifth tour. This is such an awful false equivalency, but guys are on their fifth tour. They see one of their buddies who used to be in the tour with them. What are you doing now? It's like, actually, I kind of set up with like a civilian side and I'm making six figures and I'm like getting to
right.
sleep in my own bed with my family. It's like,
yeah.
That's the version of like, hey, I'm doing, hey, I miss comedy, guys, but by the way, over here what I'm doing is
and I almost all of my friends are comics, like we've had mutual friends and been around each other for years and years and years. Like, that's a world that I still really, really love. And if, you know, Aziz decided to do a fucking season 3 of Master of None in some other country and was like, oh yeah, here, come be the writer on the food portion of this thing, I'd be like, hell yeah.
Yeah, maybe not Aziz.
Yeah, maybe not Aziz. But like, well, like,
maybe not right now, Aziz.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, let's let it
you hear that, Aziz?
Minute.
We're willing to work for you no matter what is that being said about you, right?
Okay, fine, fine. A new example. They bring back House of Cards.
Yeah.
But this one is fully food.
Kevin Spacey opens a taco truck. They need a consultant.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. Okay, Woody Allen wants me. Whatever. Like,
I'm writing on Woody Allen's new food show.
That's a bad example, but a fair point. Like,
right.
I would absolutely go take a gig if there was a fit for me on that side. And in some ways, the most money in my world is by bleeding back into the entertainment side, by doing more books, more TV, more films, things like that.
Yeah.
So that's probably inevitable. And in that sense, I end up having a little bit of a leg up, because so many people who do what I do as a food writer are just weirdos who like came off of Yelp pages and found a following.
Right.
But in the meantime, yeah, every conversation that I have with people is like, you, especially my comedy friends, they're just like, oh, where do you eat? Oh, you're so lucky to have your job. And it's like, I feel fucked. fucking great. Yeah, like Lauren Lapkus probably has $1 million by now, but I eat really well and both are cool.
Right. There is a weird element of like, well, if I really succeed in this business, what do I want to do with my money?
Yeah.
Eat at fun restaurants.
Right.
Okay, well, what if I don't have to get to success in that?
I don't need the fucking maze, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. Like, well, if my end goal is to eat at fun restaurants, and that's all I want money for, what if I just kind of make a left here and start writing about food and getting discount food, getting a food budget, right? I'm assuming your job offers you a little bit of a food stipend, bring receipts or whatever. Then I'm sure there's an element of like, you're friendly with a lot of restaurants, so you get like a slight hookup. And then there's an element of you of like that. If you have the money, where do you want to put it but except into your hobby? Like, I still pay to download movies. I don't give a fuck. I refuse to. That's where I'm eventually going to get paid from anyway.
Right.
So it's like, I don't mind giving my money to restaurants if they're good. Like that. And so it's like this interesting, you became part of the ecosystem that you wanted instead of finding a way to come in on top. You
right,
know?
Right, exactly.
Because there is the Phil Rosenthal angle too, where you're like, I really like food. I just happen to have Raymond now, so I can do this for a while, then figure out a way to get back into food via investing and eating.
Yeah, and he will have more and better and more varied restaurant experiences than I ever will, just because he happens to have all the money behind him and none of it matters. Like, I still have to be a little bit strategic in the places that I go. But I'm also operating right now at kind of a city and some national level where it's like, oh, I really want every chef in the city to know who I am and to like want to tell me things.
Yeah.
And then once that changes and you go national or start going international, then maybe the budget comes along with it or whatever. But for now, I just have so much fun being in restaurants because it's exactly the most fun and energetic place to be.
Yeah, I agree with you. I, as someone who worked in bars and stuff like that, I love that world. I actually, when I was in Barcelona with my wife over winter break, we were having such a blast and just walking around from restaurant to restaurant. Even shit like I don't even remember names of places. I just went in, was like, that place had great squid and I had 3 beers or whatever.
Right.
And then I remember like we were just saying, everyone is so nice here. And then I pitched to my wife, I'm like, here's my theory as to why there's so many cool people in Barcelona. It's such a restaurant and bar world that so many people who live here must work in service, and the vibe of service people is just more fun than the vibe of almost, you know, if everyone is a restaurant person then that works in restaurants or bartends or hangs out, those are the people that are the most fun to be out with at restaurants. Those are the most people, those are the people who are out till 4 a.m. eating and drinking and know all the cool places. And it's like a city overly populated by that is so, and that's why LA is so douchey, because we're overpopulated with people trying to make entertainment. New York is populated with people who are just exclusively trying to make money.
Right.
So like, you know, of course there's creative elements to all these worlds, but like there's just something about, but New York has a heavy service world too, where it's like the waiters and the bartenders are who you want to hang out with. And it's like, to be part of that world as part of your career is fucking exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, listen, I drive a 2005 Volkswagen Golf, like it's got 185,000 miles on it and going strong, baby. Like the things that I choose,
as long as you can get me to from Chengdu Taste to Pico and La Brea for some carnitas.
Yeah, that's like, that's the part for me that's like, oh, I could give a shit. And most chefs, you know, most people who work in the hospitality industry, you know, maybe they're saving up for something bigger, or it's part of their going to get an education somewhere else. But a lot of them are just like, yeah, I'm going to have my fucking shift drink after service, and I'm going to drive a beater and just like have the best fucking time with people.
I know.
There's a reason that like so much of pop culture will still make those references, like Party Down and Waiting. Like it's all about these people after their shift. What happens because you're so fucking livened up.
Right. Because it's such a real, I mean, and you know, drugs and alcohol are a very helpful part of that.
And very terrible sexual things and all of that is also part of it.
Right. That's true in almost any culture where it's like true unchecked power dynamic, you know, where it's like there isn't an HR department in restaurants, at least not yet. Coming in very soon.
very, very hot.
Very necessary, very soon. Well, Farley, thanks for taking the time to talk to me, man.
Of course.
This has been really exciting. I feel like we have a few more meals in our future.
Yes.
And I mean, just in general, we're going to die soon. I've got about 6 or 7 meals left of me before I croak, so let's make them happen.
It's like the five-fingered fist from like Kill Bill, right? Where you got 5 steps and then you're dead. You better make those meals count.
Well, we'll have you back on down the line after we've done some more sort of, we'll figure out some more food topics to get into, because it's been, I love talking to people who are more informed than me in certain, in worlds that I care about. So it's like very exciting. I think our travel project will be you take me to where you think your favorite pest store is, because that's like my favorite shit in the, okay, here in LA, which I, you know, there's few foods that I never even really heard of until moving here.
Right.
And El Pastor is one of them. Like, yeah, you know, it, or maybe it was on some menus at some like real Mexican places in New York, but not enough.
Yeah.
That I would have tried it. And then when I first had it here, I was like, oh my God, this is the food I've been waiting for.
Yeah. Here. Yeah. How could I not love this?
Ooh, getting wildly over here. Bet you it's an Amazon delivery, as Arthur barks at it. So Farley, what? Let's tell people the name of your book is Los Angeles Street Food.
Los Angeles Street Food: A History from Tamaleros to Taco Trucks. It's available on Amazon, bookstores. You can get it wherever. I also run Eater here in Los Angeles. That's just la.eater.com. And everywhere online, I'm over, under. Overworked, overfed, underpaid.
And I will say, if you get nothing, if you don't want to buy Farley's book, if you don't want to read his articles, at least do yourself a favor and follow Farley on Instagram.
Yes.
There are no gym selfies. There are no, there are no like, check out these fresh kicks or thanks. Like, you know, none of that bullshit. Like, shout out to the guy who sent me this free shirt. No, they are just exclusively high res, beautiful images of food. So,
yes, exactly.
Your hand features a prominence in about 60% of the photos. I love that your modeling technique is not on a plate.
Oh,
yeah. It's on the cross section view of sandwiches and tacos.
Yeah. Somebody needs to make like a mood board of my hand over the years and how it's just graying and decaying and getting fatter.
Just swollen and swollen. There's like visible saline dripping out.
Yeah. Can you be Skeletor but fat? I don't know. We're finding out.
So over, under, get his book, Los Angeles Street Food. It just arrived yesterday, so I'm looking to get cracked into it. I'm going to definitely have that open with a Google Maps app going. As always, I'm at John Gabris on Twitter. If you're an LA resident, tweet at us at some of these places that you think we might not have heard of. Farley has, but
I'll try to shut the fuck up,
but give it a go. You can get your, you know, subscribe to Action Boys, my other podcast on Patreon. You can go to actionboys.biz. Also, this week, shirts are on sale in the High and Mighty store. So go to gabris.com/shirts for discount shirts only through Sunday. And this comes out Thursday. So move your ass. All right, Farley. Thanks, bud.
Adios.
Bye, shitheads.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.